Thanks, Shane. Thank you very much.
It's the Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Good afternoon on this Thursday afternoon. How are you? 51551 or ray at rte.ie. Now, the world woke up to some pretty juicy details from Prince Harry's upcoming memoir, Spare, this morning. The book wasn't due out until next Tuesday, the 10th of January, as we were saying earlier in the week. But Martin Pengilly, the breaking news editor with The Guardian in America, managed to get his hands on a copy. And he's had all of us talking about the former Royal Harry once more. And Martin joins me on the line now from America. Good afternoon. Good morning, Martin.
Morning. Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, this is a scoop.
It's a scoop. I like that word.
Yeah. You don't like that word, or you do like that word?
Oh, I do like that word.
Yes, yes, yes. Because that's what you're in the business of scoops, aren't you? Breaking news editor. And I would imagine all the power of Penguin International was behind the security of this book, trying to make sure that nobody got their hands on it before its publication date next Tuesday. So it begs the question, before we go into the detail, Martin, how did you get your hands on the book?
That I cannot reveal.
Never reveals his sources. Yeah.
Never reveals his sources. I've been asked many times, and there's not many of us who know.
Yeah, but of course I had to ask, and I was expecting that answer. Okay, but you did, and that's the important thing. I see now that it went on sale by mistake in Spain, but you had it before them, so a number of news outlets have it now. But I suppose this thing that happened in Notcot, which is Nottingham Cottage, back in 2019. Is going to set tongues wagging, isn't it? And it was an interaction between Harry and his brother William. And you've read it, so tell us about it.
Yeah, it's described by Harry as one of many arguments in the book, which he's described such arguments before in the documentary and in trailers to the interviews he's doing. But he hasn't described the fight. It's not a fight. Actually, I shouldn't use the word fight. We didn't use the word fight. He says he didn't fight back. He says he and William argued over Meghan. He says William came for him, pushed him over, hurt his back. And he says William said he should fight back, and he didn't, even though they fought a lot as kids, which of course everybody does. Mm-hmm. And he also says that William both apologized in the instant and said, "I didn't attack you," but Harry uses the word attack.
Yeah, he says that he was grabbed by the collar and his necklace was ripped off and he was knocked to the floor, falling on the dog's bowl, which broke.
Yeah. And then he says Meghan noticed the bruising on his back later, and that's when he told her.
And he was asked by his brother not to tell Meghan.
Yes. As we know from the documentaries and the Oprah Winfrey interview the other year and so on, it's a very tangled family situation.
Yeah. And
indeed.
So it was Harry's house. They were living in Nottingham Cottage called Notcot. The names are brilliant because in the sort of interaction, at one stage, Harry calls William Willie and William calls Harry Harold. I would imagine it's like when your mother is mad at you. Like, I'm Ray, but when my mother is mad at me, she calls me Raymond. And I don't know where the Willie and the Harold come in. Maybe you can shed some light on that.
Well, it's not giving away too much. That's how Harry refers to himself and his brother throughout the book.
Okay.
It's what they call each other, as far as I know. Ah. I'm not a royal, royal watch.
Right, so there you go, right. But William, and this is, I suppose, to me, is very informative. In that chat that they were having before the push, William referred to Meghan as difficult, rude, and abrasive.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose he would know her better than most people, would he?
Well, I suppose. I don't know. You know, it's kind of an irony that I did this story because I'm a studious non-watcher of Harry and Meghan stories.
Like myself. Here's the two of us talking about things we don't really care about. Anyway, we'll continue.
The book, I mean, Harry's account of his marriage to Meghan, his account of his love for Meghan is obviously heartfelt. Mm. And his account of how he says the family didn't like her is detailed and goes on for some pages.
Right.
So,
and is it ghostwritten, Martin?
Yes, it was ghostwritten. It's ghostwritten by I can't remember his name now. It was ghostwritten by a celebrity biographer. I spent time hunting through the acknowledgements, looking for who it might be, and then I read it. Someone had reported it already. It is ghostwritten. It reads like it.
And the definition of spare, just to remind people where that comes from, because that's the title of the book.
Yeah, it's the heir and the spare. So it's a aristocratic or royal thing where the oldest son is the heir to the throne and the riches or the title or the house, and the second son is the spare in case anything goes wrong with the oldest one.
Right. And he recounts in the book a story obviously told to him by his mother after he was born, that Charles came to her and said...
Jokes. You've given me a spare. Yeah.
Wonderful. I mean, now you've given me an heir and a spare. My work is done. My word.
I'm a middle class kid from Leeds with lefty teachers as parents, and they used to joke about the heir and the spare because there are three of us.
Right. Okay.
I'm the youngest of three, so I was the spare. So you know, it's a sort of fairly well known thing. He deals with the concept of being the spare, and sometimes accuses William of behaving too much like an heir and stuff through the book.
Right. But he is an heir. So one.
Yes.
Spare, just for your information, in Ireland is a sort of a slang derogatory thing. You spare, go away, you spare. You know, you eejit, you know,
right.
If you're a spare. Oh. Just so every time I see the name of the book in print, it brings a sort of a smile to my face.
I suppose. Amateur point, but my mum would say she's going spare when she's
that's another use of the word.
Yeah.
It's going to be in 15 languages. I do. What's the end game here? Have you any idea? I know you're not a fan, but what do they? What does he hope to achieve by this book?
Well, I mean, it's. I can't speak for him.
No.
It seems fairly cathartic. He, so far as I know from having followed the story, has made a decision to sort of call time on the whole royal myth thing, as from the angles he's seen it. He obviously, as everyone knows, doesn't like the press at all, doesn't like paparazzis, thinks the whole thing is, I suppose you'd say, a gilded cage from which he has now flown. But he's also made noises about wanting to fly back, because of course you would, it's your family. I mean, He and Meghan are, you know, they've been telling their story for 2 years. It's what they're telling. It's what they do.
Yeah. That's their job now, is it? To tell their own story publicly on Netflix and anywhere else that people will listen to.
I was going to say, to turn amateur cultural historian, I mean, that's what the royals do. It's a public soap opera, it's the whole point.
Yeah. Well, you as a little class man from Leeds with lefty school teacher parents, what's your view on the monarchy? And is this a sort of a, is this, you know, death by a million cuts? Is this the beginning of the end or no?
I don't think so.
No.
I think the monarchy is central. The death of the Queen showed how central it is to British, English, identity. I mean, I always have described myself as a small R Republican. I have to say small R because I live in New York. But that doesn't infect my coverage of the story. It's a new story, and they are, you know, they are the British government. They are at the top.
Yeah, but was the whole thing around the death of the Queen, was that not about horror as opposed to the monarchy?
I saw them very much
as separate.
I think the affection for this affection for Elizabeth II was genuine and huge.
Yeah.
And it's not shared by, at the moment, any of her descendants.
Yeah.
But I think England particularly is one of the most conservative places in the world, and I don't think the royalty will go anywhere anytime soon.
Okay. The book was supposed to be published last year at some stage, but because of the death of Queen Elizabeth II, it was postponed, and it's out next Tuesday. You got your hands on a copy. Is that alluded to in the book at all, or is the book that we see that you have in your hand, is that the same one that we would have seen if the Queen didn't die?
It does cover the death of the Queen, but only briefly.
Okay.
Only briefly at the end. Yeah.
Right, okay. You're not going to tell us where you got it. That's a high five to yourself there, Martin. Well done. You can read Martin's piece in The Guardian online there. I think that Harry is quite naive, and maybe I'm wrong, but even when William called Meghan those things difficult, rude and abrasive, Harry says, according to you in the book, that he was parroting the press narrative about his American wife, which doesn't seem right. You know, that doesn't seem like something that William would do. He obviously believed that she was difficult, rude and abrasive.
Yeah, yeah, well, I mean, the press coverage of Harry and Meghan has been a whole thing, a whole subject of debate at The Guardian for a long time. Usually with me sitting at the side in news conference, quite jaundiced, but it's definitely a section of the British press has been appalling to Meghan Markle, without doubt. So if Harry thought that his brother was repeating that, then, given his view of the press in general, which is also understandable given how paparazzi have treated him and the press has treated him his entire life, I thought that line, parroting of the press narrative, sounded like something he could have said. I mean, I don't know. William could have not thought he was doing that, but it might sound like that to Harry.
And finally, before we let you go, because this is the big conundrum for somebody like me who's just sort of casually watching from the fence. They give out about the press, and yet they seem to court it at the same time. So that can't work for them.
Yeah, that's also something. I don't know if you could say Harry examines it, but you come out of the book thinking there's a dichotomy.
Yeah, and he doesn't answer that. He doesn't deal with it or reconcile it.
Not that I can remember, but no. The press, they live. I mean, like all celebrities, I suppose, but the royals are the ultimate case. They live and die by the press, and that's metaphorically, and they know that. And the push and pull is the problem, and the British tabloid press are particularly a problem in that sense. And I can't imagine it's much fun to deal with them. But then again, there are upsides to it. So yeah, I mean, I've just been seeing references to the story in the British media today, and the royal experts are obviously commenting on it, as they should. It's their job, and it's like a whole thing. Royal Watcher.
Yeah, sure. The BBC had a royal correspondent. Now we speak to her regularly, Jenny Bond. You know, thanks so much for taking time out to talk to us. You're obviously a very busy man, breaking news editor with The Guardian and king of the Today's Scoop. Anyway, Martin Pengelly. Thanks, Martin. Thank you very much. Thank you. Now 5 on 551. Latest from The Guardian, more from The Guardian. You're living the... Oh, yeah, there's various quotes there. And, of course, there are three recorded interviews with Harry that will go out over the coming days before the book. We mentioned two of them the other day. The latest one is for Good Morning America. A man called Stratton is interviewing Harry, and this is a clip from that.
The quote in this book, where you refer to your brother as your beloved brother and arch nemesis. Strong words. What did you mean by that?
There has always been this competition between us, weirdly. I think it really plays into, always played by, the heir spare.
There you go. That's Harry talking to Michael Strahan. And we played a bit of Tom Bradby's interview and the other day. So there's more now about privacy, and part of what I spoke to Martin there about the contradiction about courting the press and yet giving out about it.
I don't know how staying silent is ever going to make things better.
Wouldn't your brother say to you, Harry, how could you do this to me? After everything we went through, wouldn't that be what he would say?
He'd probably say all sorts of different things.
Some people will say, you have railed against invasions of your privacy all your life. But the accusation would be, here are you invading the privacy of your most nearest and dearest without permission. That'll be the accusation.
That'll be the accusation from the people that don't understand or don't want to believe that my family have been briefing the press.
If you're invited to the coronation, will you come?
There's a lot that can happen between now and then. But, you know, the door is always open. The ball is in their court. There's a lot to be discussed, and I really hope that they are willing to sit down and talk about it.
Do you still believe in the monarchy?
Yes.
Do you believe you'll play a part in his future?
I don't know.
Yeah, and he was asked, will he attend the coronation, which is happening, I think, in March? And he said that a lot of things can happen between now and March. So I suppose his explanation is that he has to defend himself and his family against the might of the monarchy and the big machine that they have. And they're well versed, of course, in playing the media and playing the tabloid press, etc. And he has to take that on. So that's what he's doing, what he's doing. I think that's part of the explanation. I don't know. I can't speak from, obviously. 51551, ray@rte.ie. We will tell you about our quiz in a moment, but we better take a break, yes, for a cheery tune. Do you want Rick Astley or do you want Paul Simon? Rick Astley or Paul Simon? Paul Simon it is. Thanks. Good afternoon, Paul Simon. You can call me Al. That's a cheery tune. And we put together 50 cheery tunes on a Spotify playlist to help brighten up your January. And it's there when you go to our page on the rte.ie website. You couldn't help but smile. Just to tell you that Laura de Barra, our gaff goddess, is going to be with us after 4 o'clock. So the decorations are coming down tomorrow or maybe today. The house will be bare, might look a bit bleak, but see it as an opportunity to declutter. But where do you start? How do you tackle such a task? Well, gaff goddess Laura de Barra is the woman. She knows. She's done it all. Thousands of times, well, not thousands, but definitely hundreds, because that's her job in London. And she'll be joining us after 4 o'clock. And if you have any questions for Laura about New Year, clear out, spring cleaning, all that sort of thing, ray@rte.ie, ray@rte.ie. Now, I better tell you about our quiz as well. We're looking for two of you to come on and answer 3 questions each after 4 o'clock. Questions on bits of songs, news reports, TV shows and movies. And there's a prize, and it's the week of Nullig na Mann. So if you know someone who deserves pampering and could do with a special relaxing city break, or you would love to win one for yourself, courtesy of Brooks 4-star Boutique Hotel in the heart of Dublin, listen up. They've offered us, or given us, a 2-night stay with breakfast each morning for 2 people, dinner on one of the evenings in the famous Francesca's restaurant. Brooks is situated on Drury Street, and it's right smack in the middle of Dublin city centre, and it's surrounded by some of the best boutiques and visitor attractions that Dublin has to offer. There's a car park across the road with special rates. That's very handy if you're coming up from the country. Brookshotel.ie, Brookshotel.ie, and they've devised some excellent short break packages, and you can research them on Brookshotel.ie. Okay, here's your qualifying question on this Thursday afternoon. Everyone's talking about Prince Harry's new book due for release next week. Is it called Heir or Spare? Everyone's talking about Prince Harry's, including ourselves. New book due for release next week. Is it called Heir or Spare? 0818 715 925. 0818 715 925.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Email ray@rte.ie. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, I suppose January is the time of the year when we consider our relationship with various things in our lives, and one of those things might be alcohol. I'm joined in studio by Claire Fulham. How are you doing, Claire?
I'm good. How are you?
Good to see you again.
You too.
So people might know you as Claire Balding.
Mm-hmm.
And we've spoken to you before in that sort of guise.
Mm-hmm.
So just remind us, you spoke to us because of your alopecia.
Yeah. So you kindly had me in, it's nearly 7 years ago, can you believe that, right? So 7 years ago, like it would be 7 years in the summer, and I came in and told you all about my alopecia. I was wearing a wig at the time, and I think my life has changed a lot. I'm like wondering what I'm going to speak to you about next time. Definitely think I'll be thinking or talking about this, you know. But so all my hair fell out, basically. I then went on to social media. Claire Balding was born. She's kind of like my alter ego. She's a bit cheeky. She says what she wants. She gets in trouble sometimes, but that was born, I suppose. We did like 17 live shows up and down the country. Yeah. We did Yellow Brick Road and RTE, and loads of different things came from it. Like, so it's an amazing experience, you know.
And you trained in
trichology, yeah,
which is
so,
what?
So it's the study or the specialization in the scalp and hair loss.
Okay.
So anything from scalp psoriasis to dandruff to hair loss, all that kind of stuff. So a clinic now, an online clinic now. So it's funny how things happen to you in your life, do you know, and you kind of take them. you know, and just run with them, I suppose, and kind of try and make the most out of some mad and awful situations, you know. So,
okay, so that's how we were introduced to you. First, earlier in the week, we were reading about you on independent.ie and in the newspaper, and you're talking to Lee Dawn about your relationship with alcohol.
Yes.
Okay. Right. So just so people know who you are age-wise, what age are you?
I'm 35.
35. How many children?
I have two children, 12 and 8, Farah and Elliot.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. And you're married to Ian?
Ian, yeah. Long-suffering Ian.
Is there, when you say long-suffering, how long are you together?
We'll be 18 years together this year. So we were like childhood sweethearts,
Okay.
So still trudging through. So yeah, 18 years, married 10 years in the summer. So yeah, a very full, busy life, yeah.
And you haven't touched a drop of alcohol in how long?
On St. Patrick's Day, it will be 2 years. So coming up to 2 years. So just over 18 months,
Closer to 2 years than 18 months.
Yeah.
And is that anniversary, is that important to you?
Oh, hugely important, yeah. I can't wait to get there. So, you know, that kind of way, I'm kind of really looking forward to kind of that milestone. It's kind of another, you know, I suppose, notch on the belt a little bit. It's kind of that further into the life that I want and the life that, you know, is right in front of me, that like kind of just every day that goes by that I stay away from alcohol, I'm winning, you know. So really important to me, yeah.
So describe then what it was like before St. Patrick's Day 2021.
So I suppose like I've always been the party gal, like even though I had my children young, I suppose like when a mother is let loose, she goes a bit mad. So I've always kind of been a big drinker. I always loved a drink. I've been known for that. I suppose I always have a story about guess what happened to me. Always that type of person. And always push the boundaries with alcohol, I would say, you know, always the last one to leave, all that kind of stuff, which is grand, you know, and it's a lot of people's personalities and relationships with alcohol. I suppose when my hair fell out, I started to lean on it a little bit more, you know, to kind of release the daily stresses, you know, of being a mother, of losing my hair, of having this online presence all of a sudden as well. So I started to kind
and
of
course,
reward.
Of course, we're sold that, and it is a lie.
Yeah.
We're sold that lie that, you know, you deserve it because you're stressed out and this is going to relieve the stress.
I know.
And ultimately, it's the last thing it does.
Oh, my God. And it's like we put it on such a pedestal. I can't believe how much of a pedestal I used to put it on, you know, and how much of a lifeline it then started to become for me, you know. But I did start to lean on a little bit more, I suppose, after my hair fell out. And it was that. It was just the daily wear and tear of pretending I was okay because I wasn't okay, you know. So after that point, then I think I was this, I always speak about this really thin grey line somewhere, right, that a lot of big drinkers and heavy drinkers dance along, you know, and you don't know when you're going to cross that line or if you'll ever cross that line, but that line is addiction, you know. And I think in early 2020, I went over that line. I realised that my best friend, who was alcohol, which is hard for me to say, but it was my best friend. It was keeping me alive. It was the thing that woke me up, you know, that gave me Claire back in some ways, and it levelled me out stress-wise. So when it
when
kind
you
of
say
turned,
it woke you up, were you drinking in the morning?
No. But I always had alcohol in my system. You know, I wasn't drinking in the morning, but I always had alcohol. I'd always top myself up that evening. That kind of
okay,
way.
So you were drinking every day?
Yes.
But not
at the
during
end,
the day?
Yes. Okay. But at the end, I would have been drinking every day, yeah. But I think that line that I was speaking about, like, you know, as I said, heavy drinkers lie and dance around that line a lot. And when you go over that line, you can't come back, you know. And I think that I realised in 2020 that I'm now over this line. My best friend, alcohol, couldn't believe it had turned its back on me. And now all of a sudden it's something that is an absolute requirement every day for me to live my life. It was my medicine, you know. So I went over that and knew that and been told by the doctors to stop drinking alcohol. My liver was hanging out my bum. And they just said, you have to stop, Claire. I didn't stop because I couldn't, because I was addicted. And then I heard the gorgeous Sophie White and Miriam McCallaghan, and it completely changed my life. I suppose that's why I'm talking to you, you know.
Yeah. So she was on talking about her experience with alcohol.
Yeah.
Right.
So Sophie is a podcaster and author, and I was on her podcast before, probably drunk, the two of us, but we had a great time. And I remember, so I knew Sophie, so important, you know. I think representation is so important because most of the time when we think of someone that's struggling with alcoholism or a problem drinker, whatever that is, right, alcoholic is a weird word. Some of us like it, some of us don't like it. And not just alcoholics have a problem with that word, you know. So I think it's a really difficult one, because we kind of assume that everyone that sits in that realm, you know, is a nuisance, is a pest, is selfish, is all these things. And I wasn't any of those things. Mm. And when I heard Sophie speak about it so eloquently, it woke me up. And it was the first time I'd seen myself in somebody else. And about 2 or 3 days after that interview, I haven't drank since.
It's interesting what you said there. I'm wondering, do people... and that's the word that's used an awful lot now, other. Do they other people who they consider to be alcoholics? And that sort of saves them from considering their own situation, because if they're othered, then I've no problem.
Yes.
They're an alcoholic, they're different to me.
Yeah.
I don't have a problem.
I did that.
Did you?
Yeah. Right. I used to say, God, like somebody would say to me, God, did you hear about Mary now? She had to go in somewhere, or did you hear that he or she is not drinking? And I'm like, oh my God. Like, and I used to ask, how much were they drinking? When do they drink? Do they drink every day? What do they drink? Because I was obsessed with figuring out what is it that makes that person.
Oh, as if there was a scientific measure
Absolutely.
Of what made you an alcoholic.
Yes.
Of course,
so
there
I was
isn't.
Like, what? There isn't, no. right? And it's different for everybody as well. There's realms and spectrums to this too. But I was obsessed by that. I wanted to know, how much did she drink every day? Because I was... absolutely knew that I had a huge problem with alcohol, but I could never see my life without it, you know. So I was always trying to measure that, you know. And absolutely, I think that sometimes when I say to people, oh, I don't drink anymore, and, you know, other people will kind of, oh, and that's on them. That's their issue. That's their mirror.
What
me
do you say, though?
I tell them I'm an alcoholic.
Do you?
Because it shuts them up. Yeah. Because initially I didn't, right? I gave up on St. Patrick's Day, and I said to everyone, I'm just trying to lose a bit of weight. And they kind of left me alone because it was 2021, so we didn't see many people, right? So it's fine. But I had this week booked in Wexford with my friends, Kieran and Phil. And I was like, I'm going to that. I'm going to have a drink in July. I'll have a drink in July. And I told everyone that. Well, I knew damn well I was going to try my best never to have a drink again. But I didn't say those words for a long time. At the time, I was off social media. I had to come off it because I was literally losing my mind. Mm. And, you know, after that point, then I'd start every day that went by, I got braver. I'd listen to another podcast, I'd read another book, I'd read another article on what is this and try to figure it out. I went to meetings online. And every day I got stronger. So then about August time, I think. So what's that? Maybe, you know, not even.
8 to 5 months.
Yeah, five months on, I said to my mum and dad, look, I'm not trying to, you know, I'm not trying to lose weight. This is because I have a problem with alcohol.
Right.
I'm going to meetings. I don't want you to hear that from anybody else. This is me telling you this. And from once they were told, I felt like I could share it with other people then. Do you know that kind of way? It's very difficult. It's the hardest thing you'll ever have to do, because it's such seeped in shame and guilt and everything else.
And just because the word alcoholic is interesting, isn't it?
Yes.
And you're using it nearly as armour, are you?
Oh my God, yeah.
Ah, I see.
It's the best armour I've ever had, you know, because first of all, it just, it stops any sort of conversation about... wow, will you not? Because they think that I can't, right? That I don't agree with that either, right? I think that, anyway, it's another conversation.
No, for example, I see an ad for one of the zero alcoholic drinks. I think it might be Heineken.
Yeah.
And their tagline is, zero explanation needed.
Yes.
So they know that if you go into a situation, a social situation, and you don't drink, you have to explain.
I know. And it's like the only drug in the world that you have to explain why you're not taking it, which is so weird. And, you know, I see it in other countries, like from listening to other podcasts and reading other books, it doesn't happen as much as it happens here in Ireland. You know, I think that we do have this odd relationship with alcohol. And I think we know it's there, right? Most people know that something's bubbling under the surface. It's a deep, dark secret. And no one wants to look into that hole, because once you see it, you'll never unsee it. And it's hard, you know, it's really, really hard not to drink here.
What reaction have you got then? So was the article then, that interview, was that the first time you went public?
No, I speak about it on Instagram.
And what reaction do you get from people?
Mainly positive, you know, like I think like genuinely, so like honestly, hand on my heart, thousands of people wanting to stop as well or trying to get control over it. So that's a big issue.
Big
you know?
Issue. So what questions are they asking you then?
How do I stop?
Yes.
How do I manage social situations? How do I tell my family? What if this, you know, the school, a lot of mothers, a lot of mammies in this situation, and the guilt and the shame that people think my kids aren't being looked after. I'm telling you now, my kids were always looked after. It's not the same for everybody, you know, like it's not the same. It's not this what we think an alcoholic, again, perhaps looks like, you know, it's everyday people. I'm telling you now, in this building in RTE, there's people sitting there, you know, riddled with the anxiety of trying to control this situation. It's a really dark secret that nobody wants to speak about. But the more...
Why do you think that's the case?
Because it touches everybody. And we use alcohol too much to numb ourselves from all of the stuff going on in our life. And it's an absolute lifeline for most people, you know?
But now that you have the clarity of nearly 2 years not drinking... You can see that that's a lie.
Oh my God, that's such a lie.
Yeah.
I've had the best 2 years of my life, you know, for loads of different reasons. I went travel around Thailand with my family this summer. I'm just back from the Netherlands. I've way more money. I'm paying the bloody electricity and everything else like everyone else is. But the joy, and it's like you've just woken up. You've just woken up. You've just been a new life, a new birth. It's crazy, you know, like live music sounds better. Nature looks better. Everything's better. So I don't know where alcohol gets off pretending it's our friend, because some people's friends, okay, but I know more problem drinkers than I do normal drinkers, and so do us all. You know,
You see, again, people are listening now and they go, and you've nearly touched on it there, that it's fine for me, fine for me, you know, I'm fine with it.
Yes,
but what you think is that most people aren't fine with it, but they're reluctant to admit to it.
Yeah. There's this big movement online, which I'd really encourage people to get involved with. And it's called Sober Curious, right? So you don't have to have a problem with drink to say to give it up for Dry January or Sober October or whatever it is, right? Whatever spin the 0% beers are given, right? Whatever that is. But, you know, dip your toe into the water. But people are afraid of what other people are going to think. That's mad, okay. You know?
Now, the thing with alcoholism, and I remember getting a lift with this man years ago, and he told me the story of him being an alcoholic, and he was giving me a lift to a disco. It meant that he had to wait for me for 4 hours in an environment where there was drink, and I was so fearful that he would go back on the beer, you know. As it turns out, he was off the beer for a number of years, but that's what he did. He had to keep the story alive and keep it fresh for him. But there is this thing, this image, and I don't know if you share it, that there is a fear, there's a constant fear of going back on the beer. Does that exist for you?
No. And it never has, actually. Once I made that decision, I was quite clear with myself. Now, do I think that I'll never drink again? No, I don't have that confidence in myself, because, you know, the addict inside you will always try and rule that part of your life if you're addicted. But I will sure as hell do everything in my power not to get to that point, you know. But you spoke about there this clarity that I have now. Like, I'm like a new person completely, you know. I think quicker. I'm 15 years younger in my head. I act like a teenager again. Like, so, you know, I my life is better. So do I ever want to drink again? Absolutely not. You know, I see this wonderful life in front of me, and I wouldn't have had that life if I, you know, had kept drinking, you know. But I think there's this kind of animalistic fear.
Where's the crack? Where, how can you have fun?
Oh my God, there's so much fun out there. First of all, it's funny to laugh along with drunk people. Like, people say awful things when you're drunk, or funny things when you're drunk, you know. I do find those, you know, I leave earlier now, you know, because I want to get up in the morning and go and live my life, you know. And it's, you absolutely can still have fun. As I said, live music sounds better. Food tastes nicer. Everything is just elevated that little bit more, you know.
What about your relationship with your children?
Oh, it's completely changed for the better, you know. I'm very proud to say, thanks be to God, that my children were never hugely affected by that. As I said, they were always in time for school. They always had food. There was no dramatics, really, to my situation. I know that's not the same for everybody. So they were always really loved children. But now I have more patience for them, you know. I'm not constantly, when are they going to bed? When are they going to bed so I can have a drink? There's none of that, you know. I'm present with them. They have a way better mommy now, you know, that I'm not ruled and I'm not completely imprisoned by that. Because what I was trying to do, and Sophie said this, and I'm going to nick it on her because it stuck with me forever, is that every day I used to light this fire, and I spent all day trying to control that fire so it wouldn't ravage my family. That's what alcoholism is. It's trying to control that. And ultimately, one day you won't be able to control that anymore.
But you're fighting a big fight because the might of the alcohol industry, it's huge.
Huge. But
all of those things, you know, wine time, because I deserve it.
The mammy wine culture is huge. Like, all that stuff is humongous, you know. And I don't think it's my fight. Like, you know, I don't think so.
Oh, yeah, I know. Yeah. I understand that. But I think, and the clarity that you have, maybe, you see now.
Yeah.
And this is the thing. I remember seeing that the movie with Insider. It's a true story. Russell Crowe. Mm-hmm. Russell Crowe plays this guy who works in the tobacco industry.
Yeah.
And he was a whistleblower.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so he knew what they knew.
Mm-hmm.
He was trying to tell the world they were trying to silence him.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, what I got from that was that people who smoked were duped by the tobacco industry.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly, I think, and we're going to see this in the coming years, decades, that people will realise that they've been duped by the alcohol industry.
Absolutely. It's so sexy and so sold to us, alcohol, you know, in every realm of your life, like, you know, pints with the lads, wine with the mammies, you know, like everything, you know, we can't escape it. So it's really difficult to stay sober in this world. 100%. It really is, because, you know, you do feel constantly like the strange one, you know. There's no doubt. And there's so many people as well that don't drink and have never drank, you know, that will say the same thing, like, oh my God, I have to explain myself all the time that, you know, I've never drank. Or, you know, it's always like, God, are you expecting, Claire? Or there's always questions about it, you know. It's odd.
And here's the thing, just back to the word again, alcoholic. Because you've never been diagnosed as such,
No.
You decided to take that label on yourself.
I think I hated it at the start, and I was terrified by the word because of everyone else's and my own, you know, notions about what that meant, you know. But now what I realise is that, you know, it's just a word, just a word. But, you know, it's what you do with that, you know. And if it means something to you, use it. If you don't like it, don't use it, you know.
My wife drinks every day. This is a texter as well. It's got to the point that I'm thinking walking away from my wife of 25 years. I classify her as a functioning alcoholic. Our kids have just left the nest and she just seems to drink more now at weekends, seeing as they are no longer there. Don't know what to do. She just argues with me when I try to talk to her. That's one. And can you ask your guest what is the best advice? I promised myself at 40 I'd give up the vino. 20 years later, I'm still struggling with same questions. I worry more about my health more than anything else. I've tried AA a few times, but every time I consider giving up, I think of next social event and say, OK, after that, I have a few drinks every day, says that person.
And that's all the time. I get those messages every day, you know, on social media.
Like, and what do you say to them?
I can't help everyone.
Of course. You're not qualified either.
No,
but I suppose from your lived experience, as they say now, it does qualify you.
You have to create boundaries for yourself. You have to be dedicated that this is the way you want to live your life. You know, you do have to be very, very strong, and you have to have a support system around you, whether that is an AA meeting, whether that's your husband, your wife, your friend. You have to have someone there shouting for you and making sure that,
and
you know,
mentioned books and podcasts. Yeah. Did they help?
Hugely.
Why they so? Helped me.
Listening to other people's stories, you know, and that's what AA does for people, millions of people all day, every day around the world, listening to being able to relate to people, all that kind of stuff. But you have to tell that story, you know. That's the only way that we're going to drag this into the light, because it is bubbling there for most people, you know. It's bubbling. And unless you act on that.
It's funny you say that, because there's been a number of articles over the last 6 to 8 months, say in the Irish Times, about people telling their stories. And I've noticed that they are the most read article for a number of days after they appear.
Yeah.
So you're right. There is, people are curious. The people want to know how it can be done, how they can achieve it.
But I think the only way, that's not even the person that's drinking too much's job. It's everyone else to facilitate that. It's you as a friend. It's you as a husband, as a brother.
To facilitate somebody not drinking.
Yes. It's going, do you know what? Like, well, oh, do you know what? You're not having a beer then. That's absolutely fine. Do you want a cup of coffee? Would you like a glass of water? Not asking people to explain themselves, you know? Like, not rolling your eyes in the pub when your friend orders a 0.0 Heineken, you know. You don't know. Like, you don't have to have this really turbulent addict life to have a problem with alcohol. I know someone who's trying to cut down because he has 5 nights of nightmares after 4 pints. That's not right.
No.
Like, that's enough to give up, you know. Like, and there's a life out there to be lived, you know. You just have to go and grab it.
Yeah. Claire, thanks so much for coming in and being so honest with us.
Thank you.
And we'll talk again.
Of course.
I'm sure
God knows what about.
For the moment, Claire Fulham, thank you. Mind yourself.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Text 51551. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, the last time we had Emmy-nominated costume designer Emer Ní Bhfuil Downing in studio, it was to talk to us about her wonderful work on The Banshees of Inisherin, which I'm sure a lot of people have seen since we spoke to her because it's available to stream now. And we heard a little bit about another thing that Emer is involved in, and that's the Irish Costume Archive Project. Well, Emer is back with us today, along with a few wonderful examples of costumes they're trying to collect, preserve and make available to be displayed to the public. Good afternoon, Emer.
Hi, Ray.
And great hello, ladies, you. Because you brought in three mannequins. I can call them ladies because they're not actually living people. What is the collective? What's your preferred collective noun for a group of women?
For a group of women?
Yeah, because lady, I don't like ladies. God. Do you like lady?
I have no problem with ladies. Yeah. I know some people do, but just, you know, it's all good.
So we've three dresses. From left to right, we have a dress from...
On Colleen Kuhn. So that was worn by Catherine Clinch and designed by Louise Stanton.
Right. In the middle?
In the middle we have Angela Lansbury from a BBC production of Little Women, and I designed that production in 2017. And on the right we have Daisy Edgar-Jones in her role as Marianne in Normal People, designed by Lorna Marie Mugan.
Right. Now, I'm curious. You see, I thought when I watched television that if it's a period piece, mm-hmm. that people had to make them from scratch.
Yep.
But if it was a modern piece, like Normal People, that they just went into Zara or wherever and bought a dress. But that's not the way it is it?
No, I mean, it's not about, you know, there is kind of a conception that it's maybe shopping or, you know, especially now with the advent of stylists and all of that kind of thing, you know. But I mean, for Lorna, when she was doing Normal People, I think it's fair to say, you know, that, I mean, you know, it's all about the character. So, I mean, it's very possible Lorna went into Zara and bought some things, but she bought them thinking what would Marianne wear in this situation. So this particular dress is a vintage dress.
Aha, right.
So it's 1950s.
Right.
I think Lorna bought it in Jenny Vander's in Dublin.
And it's made from?
It's a silk crepe.
Right.
And it's a beautiful coral colour. I mean, it's really stunning, and it's actually a good example of one of the costumes in the collection that, you know, needs to be really kind of looked after properly. Mm. It needs a bit of TLC.
And we'll talk about that in a moment.
Yeah.
But Daisy Edgar-Jones mm-hmm. wore that in the Italian trip.
Was it the Italian trip? Was a party scene.
A party scene,
yeah,
right.
Yeah,
okay.
One of the student party scenes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Little Women, Angela Lansbury,
yeah,
who's not with
yeah.
us anymore, which is very sad. And Colleen Kuhn.
Catherine Clinch.
Yeah, which is an amazing.
Yes, yeah.
Like, and
yeah, yeah.
Like, we're fingers crossed because it's,
absolutely.
I think it's 18 days now to the announcement
countdown
of the nominations for the Oscar. We'll talk about that as well in a moment. So the Irish Costume Archive Project is the work of yourself and...
Virla Dehane.
Right, and how old is it?
So we started it officially in 2017.
And with the notion of collecting all of these wonderful costumes from Irish movies, Irish-made movies.
Exactly. So it was something that was at the back of our minds for a while. There was a Joan Bergen, who's a very well-known Irish costume designer. She's won three Emmys. And Joan had a costume rental place in Capel Street called the Costume Mill. And I stored my costumes there also. The building was bought. It's being developed into a hotel. Joan, you know, we couldn't find anywhere within a budget, you know, to rent. So the whole collection that Joan had was being sold off, and it was sold to a big costume house in Madrid, Lock, Stock and Barrel. But Virla and I approached Joan and said, let's just try and... You know, so that was the kernel to save. We knew, we went through the whole collection. We knew there were costumes from My Left Foot, In the Name of the Father, The Tudors, Dancing at Lunasa. But it's not just like the third policeman from the right. You know, we have a, you know, quite a strict collection policy. So Dancing at Lunasa, we have Meryl Streep.
Yes.
In the Name of the Father,
that's
it's Daniel Day-Lewis.
Yeah, but that's an expression, you know? The third policeman from the right.
Yeah.
Is that an expression in the movies? Is it?
No, maybe it is, but it's, you know, yeah. It's
so
kind
it's
of,
the stars,
yeah.
What the stars wore. Yes,
yeah, it's important, you know, it's because these are the people who are the storytellers in the movie. So, you know, and it's what people want to see. And it's also usually where the budget is being spent in terms of the costume.
So many pieces would you have? now?
We have over 200.
Right.
We have a sizable collection.
And if you were to name any of the great movies that are made in Ireland, you would have something from it. Like, you have something from Braveheart.
Please don't name something that we don't have.
Well, you have the Commitments.
Okay, the Braveheart.
Yes. Commitments, Braveheart.
So the Commitments and Braveheart are quite interesting, actually, because, you know, we have this permanent collection that we have ourselves, and then we have a few people that we kind of collaborate with. So we have a wonderful friend who's a private collector. So the Braveheart costume is actually his.
Uh-huh.
Now, he doesn't want to be named, but, you know, and then the Commitments.
What does he do with it?
What does he do?
He's listening, so I don't think he'd mind me saying.
He actually has a mini museum in his attic.
Right.
In Dublin.
Right. A bit like...
Incredible.
A bit like Hugh Grant in Paddington 2.
Yeah. Incredible.
And does he have mannequins? Are they all
mannequins? Yeah, he does. Right. He has them all in mannequins.
Wow.
And he's an amazing person. And
right.
We love him to bits.
So he would lend this out to yours? Or you can include it?
We know what he has. Or he'll say, oh, I just bought this. And we'll go, oh, great. We have an exhibition coming up. You know.
Yeah.
But like, most of the collection is ours. You know, and then we have a few pieces, and from the Commitments, like there, that was Brona Gallagher's own jacket and her shoes, you know, and Brona has lent them to it. Brona is amazing.
Yeah,
I'm sure you've met Brona.
Lovely woman, yes.
Fabulous person. And, you know, so Brona has lent those to us.
Now, here's the thing. At the moment, they're in storage out in Ardmore,
yeah.
Right,
mm-hmm.
which is not ideal.
And
as you were saying about Daisy Edgar Jones, it needs a little bit of TLC.
Yes, yeah.
So, putting it into a vacuum bag probably isn't quite enough.
Yeah.
But would ideally, wouldn't it be great to have these on public display where people can come in? It would definitely be a tourist attraction.
Absolutely.
And you've thought of that and we've discussed it. And
we've had drinks about it. We've thought about it. We've, you know, had meetings.
Endless meetings.
And, you know, we've approached different people and, you know, people pay wonderful lip service.
What about William down in Newbridge Silverware? Have you spoken to him?
Well, I actually tried phoning them on the way here today
right.
to kind of say, would you listen into this? And I just got an answering machine.
Because William is an amazing man and he's a collector.
Absolutely. I think he is incredible. We would love to have some kind of collaboration with Newbridge. I think that's the only way forward for us now. You know, 6 years ago, Virla and I were very, yes, we're going to do this together. We're going to do it. And now we're saying, it would be great if somebody could collaborate with us.
I can't believe you haven't spoken to Newbridge Silverware before this.
We're very shy and retiring. Now, we were kind of busy working, that's the problem as well. This is our passion project. It's a passion project.
Yeah.
Thank you. I didn't want to say pet project because it's not.
No.
It's a passion project, and it's something, you know, we really want to protect. And people love it when we exhibit these.
I tell you what, if William contacts you and you end up setting it up, we promise that we will do an outside broadcast from the opening.
William,
yes.
Are you listening?
Yes, you go.
We love you. We love what you do.
Yes, and we've done shows from there before.
Yeah, we think they're amazing. I love what he's done. I'm a huge admirer of what he's done.
There you go.
William.
It all started here.
Okay.
Well, that's good. That's a good day's
Thanks,
work,
Ray.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Cheers. I'm off now.
Eimear, thank you so much and good luck, and we will be talking again. And just before you go, right, what's the rumour mill like around the Oscars?
Oh,
you must be on a Banshees of Inisherin WhatsApp group.
How many Banshees of Inisherin WhatsApp groups are there? There's various WhatsApp groups. I mean, we're all really, you know, I went over to London a couple of weeks ago to do a BAFTA thing, and Ben Davis, who's the DOP, said that night, he and I met first and then...
Director of photography.
Director of photography, thank you.
Yeah.
And he said, we're doing this for Martin. And I said, absolutely, Martin McDonagh.
Yes.
We all love him so much. He was just the most wonderful person to work with. And if I could work with him for the rest of my life, I would die a happy woman. You know, so I really hope Martin is recognised, his work is recognised, and Colin... And Brendan, and if Barry and Kerry, you know, there's a lot of fantastic, talented.
Kerry Condon.
It's okay.
She's
Kerry
amazing.
Yeah, she's wonderful, and Barry is super.
Yeah.
And they were amazing people to work with, and so collaborative.
Okay. Fingers crossed.
Cheers.
Right, Eimear, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Gramaga Coit, thank you very much. 51551ray@rt.ie. We spoke to Claire Fulham, and her Instagram name is Claire Balding because she suffers with alopecia. She was the lady we were talking to about drink. Great woman, brave. I was down that road and I'm still ashamed I don't drink now. And I'm ashamed of what I did when I did drink. Right, that's that person. I suppose the reason Claire so enthusiastically shared her story is that she feels by doing that, she will help others. And as she said, it's bubbling under there and it's a dark secret and we need to talk about it more. And that's why she came in and shared her story today. Now, we have two people lined up for our quiz. And there's a prize. It's the week of Nullig na Mann. Tomorrow is Nullig na Mann, actually, the 6th of January. And if you know someone who deserves pampering or could do with a special relaxing city break, or you would love to win one yourself, we have a two-night stay in the Brooks 4-star boutique hotel in the heart of Dublin City to give away. It's on Drury Street, surrounded by some of the best boutiques and visitor attractions the city has to offer. They've put together some great, excellent short breaks in Dublin City Centre. You can find out about them. Brookshotel.ie or a Dublin number 674,000. 674,000. Hello, Susan Sugru.
Hi, how are things?
Not too bad. It's Susan as opposed to Suzanne?
Susan and Shukru as opposed to
Shukru. Shukru, okay, right. Shukru, yeah. As opposed to Sugru. Right, Shukru. And what's the history of that name, Susan? Any idea?
It's my husband.
Oh, it's your husband's. So yeah, you're okay. Yeah, fair enough. I didn't bother. It's, only, it's his.
it's not mine. I think some branch of O'Sullivan.
Okay. And you're on your way back to Kerry from Dublin. What were you doing in Dublin?
That's right, yeah. We brought the kids up for a few days and went to the Panto and the zoo and the galleries and things like that. It was lovely.
Ah, brilliant. What age are the kids?
They're probably a bit young for the galleries. They're 3 and 4.
Right, okay. They probably found them a little bit.
The Panto and the zoo anyway.
Yeah, and you got to the Disney store, which is good.
Yes.
And were there purchases?
There were a couple of teddies, all right, Copper and the Cheshire Cat.
Right. And I believe Tom has named the Cheshire Cat.
Ginger, despite it being pink and purple. Yeah.
He probably doesn't understand what ginger is. It's just the name of a cat as opposed to a colour.
Yeah.
So whereabouts in Kerry are you heading back to?
To Tralee.
Tralee, okay. Whereabouts are you, do you know?
We are coming into Adair soon enough, coming into Limerick,
Adair, it signals that you're near home, but still it can be a bit of a bottleneck there.
That's it.
But you can't do anything about it, can you?
tight.
Yeah, that's it. You're up against Kieran O'Sullivan, who's in Lay Town in County Meath. Hello, Kieran. No, Neil Shea on Shea.
How are you, Ray?
There you are.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Can you hear me?
Yes, you're coming in loudly and clearly. Can you hear me?
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Yes. Great.
Susan is on the other line there. You can say hello to Susan.
Hi, Susan. How are you doing?
Hi, Kieran. How are you?
Yeah, great. We were worried that we'd lost you. So you're in Laytown, just in from work, I believe.
Probably about an hour or so ago, yeah.
Right, okay. And who's at home with you?
Right now, there's three. Three boys. All here. So,
what ages are they?
They're from 19, 15, and 9. So right. We have a bit of a spread.
Yeah.
So two of them just in from school in the last hour, and the older fella is otherwise occupied.
Yes, and first day back, which is always very tiring, isn't it?
First day back.
Yeah.
Well, I was in work early this morning and since late last night, so it was somebody else's task to get them up.
Okay. I believe you were stripping the beds and putting on washes.
When the call went through, yes, I was in and stripping beds, putting on washes, and I guess we'll have to get them a dinner at some stage.
Yeah, what would that be? Yeah. Any idea?
Well, I stopped in for a bit of salmon on the way home.
Nice. How will you cook it?
Would you like me to describe the whole process?
Well, are you poaching it or frying it or roasting it or baking it?
Baked,
right. Okay, fair enough. Yes. Baked, yeah. So that's nice. I like a bit of baked salmon. Have you any interest in Harry and his spare book?
Well, as the 19-year-old was saying to me as the radio was on and you were talking about it, he asked me, do you have any interest in that fella? He asked me, do you think about that fella and what he's doing? And I said, I don't think about that fella at all.
Oh, you don't think about him, right,
and he says, And he says, yeah, that's the, exactly the same as me. Mum thinks about him all the time. So,
yeah, it's a bit of diversion. And I know it's real people's lives, but, you know, from a distance, it's a bit of diversion.
Yeah, well, for some of us, it's of no consequence.
No consequence whatsoever.
And for others, it's great entertainment.
Yes, that's it. Okay. Right. So Susan plays Kieran. It's three questions each. If you go for a long clip, you get a point. If you get it right, of course. And if you go for a shorter clip and get it right, you get 2 points. And whoever has the most points at the end is the winner. And if it's a draw, we go to a tiebreak question. Good luck to you both. Here we go. Right, yo, Susan, the year is 1997.
Yep. Right.
Okay, and we're starting on the television. Do you want a long clip or a short clip?
A short clip.
Okay. This irreverent American cartoon, created by Trey Parker and Matt Stone, about four foul-mouthed friends, hit our screens for the first time in 1997. Have a listen and see if you can tell us the name. Short clip.
Hey, where's the school bus? We're going to be late for football practice. Who's that? That's my new dog, Sparky. He followed me to the bus stop.
South Park.
It's correct. Well done. You got 2 points there. Kieran, good start by Susan. You're under a bit of pressure from the get-go.
From the off. She has me on the back foot.
Yes. What do you want to do? It's telly from 1997.
Well, I best go for a short clip, so.
Okay. So apologies in advance to parents who had to endure this British children's TV programme, which first dated in 1997. Have a listen to the clip and see if you can tell us the name.
Tinky Winky.
That wouldn't happen to be the Teletubbies.
Yes, you have a 15 and 19 year old, so they at some stage probably.
They had made their mark in this house.
Yeah, for an extra point, can you name them all? For an extra point, can you? No, there's no extra points.
For an extra point.
Just for the crack, can you
Tinky
name them all?
Tinky Winky,
yeah.
Dipsy,
yeah.
Lala, yeah. And Poe.
Well done, no extra points. That's good stuff. Well remembered, Kieran. Well remembered. Okay, good start.
Many of the long afternoons.
Yeah, Susan, question number two is on. Music from 1997. Yep. Would you like a long clip or a short clip?
Short clip.
Okay. Huge hit from 1997. Can you tell me the name of the song or the name of the band?
I can't think of it.
Yeah. No. I'll take the name of the band or. A stab at either would do me the band or the song.
Symphony Orchestra. No, I can't think of
it. No. Oh, you were so close.
Yeah.
Bittersweet Symphony. We needed the three
symphony,
words and the verb. And
your grand.
Yeah, okay. And they were in a legal tussle with Rolling Stones after that because they sampled a 1965 version of The Last Time. Anyway, so no points there. Kieran, a chance for you to go in front now. Music from 1997. Do you want a long clip or a short clip?
I wouldn't have thought this would be my strong suit, so I might go for a long clip.
Okay. This was not their most popular song, but it reached number one in Ireland in 1997. Can you name the song or the band?
Would the band be Oasis?
It would. Do you know what I mean?
I can't think of the name of the song.
No, you don't have to. Do you know what I mean is the name of the song. You get a point for that. So you're on three. Susan, you're on two. If you go short and get it right, you're on four. And then Kieran can go for a short one, get it right, and he would be today's winner. He could go for a long one, get it right, and then it brings us to a tiebreak. Or he could get it wrong, and you would be the winner if you go short. If you go long, you only get a point. If you get it right, you'll be even with Kieran. And then if he gets anything from his last question, he will be the winner. So what do you want to do?
We'll go short again.
Short, okay. It's news and current affairs-ish from 1997. Before they hit the big time, this boy band performed under a different name. Have a listen to this clip from 1997 and see if you can tell me what they changed their name to. Okay?
Okay.
Short clip.
A visit from Sligo's answer to Boyzone, the up-and-coming band IOU.
Westlife?
Is the correct answer. Yes. So IOU member Shane Phelan, Keane Egan and Mark Feely went on to join up with Nicky Byrne and Brian McFadden to be Westlife, and you get 2 points for that. You are on four. Is that correct? Yes. Kieran, you're on three. So if you go short and get it right, you're today's winner. Go long and get it right, it's a draw. And if you get it wrong on either count, Susan wins. So what do you want to do?
I shall have a go at the short one.
Okay, a go at the short one, right. History was made in Scotland when scientists successfully created the first clone of an adult animal. Have a listen to the clip and see if you can tell me what they named her. Short clip.
She was grown from a single cell taken from a sheep's udder, and she's about to revolutionise the breeding of animals.
Would that be Dolly the sheep?
Yes, Dolly the sheep was born at the Roslin Institute in Edinburgh. Great book about how they did that. It's hard to believe that was 1997.
That's incredible. That's 25 years ago.
Yeah. Mad. Anyway, you get 2 points. You're on five. Today's winner. Susan, you did really well.
Well done.
Yeah. It's a bittersweet. Bittersweet.
No, symphony. No, no. Sorry, it was lovely. Thank you very much.
Yeah. We're going to send you out a couple, not one. I'm only allowed to say one now, not a couple. We're going to send you out one Radar Show Keep Cup. Drive safely.
Awesome.
And
will do.
Yeah, and safe home. Thanks, Susan. Well
thanks
done. See you.
Much.
Bye.
Well
bye.
Done, Kieran.
Bye. Kieran, you are off to the Brook Hotel with a person of your choice for two nights. Nice.
It'll not be a person of my choice. She'll tell me who's coming with me.
Yeah. And Vicky will be your name. Yes.
And Vicky will be your name. Yeah.
Brookshotel.ie to see what's in store for you. Okay, Kieran, good luck with the changing
Cheers,
of the sheets and the dinner. Bye now. Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Cheers. Bye.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Email ray@rte.ie. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE
Radio.
Yeah,
we're going live to London shortly to speak to the gaff goddess Laura De Barra, but there was a bit of consternation at the top of the show when the people outside chose Paul Simon over Rick Astley. So just to make amends, we play a bit of this. Doc Aiken and Waterman produced Rick Astley's Never Gonna Give You Up. Now, the post-Christmas clear-out is upon us. Once the decorations come down, the house might look a bit bare, a bit bleak, but looking at it as an opportunity to declutter. But how do you tackle such a task? Well, we have the perfect woman on hand in London, gaff goddess Laura De Barra. Happy New Year. Good afternoon.
Happy New Year.
Now, because the house does look bare. We did it on Tuesday. And when you take down all the decorations, there's a gap. There's a void.
I kind of like the minimal feeling after. Yeah, I love it.
Well, you see,
but I know what you mean. You get used to it.
You gave us advice before Christmas that we put everything away, that we were, and then we replace it with the decorations. Then we take decorations away. And should we now look at the things that we put away and say they really need to be there?
Yeah, I think it's a really stunning time to assess, because I do think that we, without realising it, we live very seasonally. There's things in our homes that we, it's not just Christmas, you know, like this time of year, you might not want certain things out and about or in your way. You might leave your house in a different way during the winter, like putting on coats and stuff than you do in the summer. So it's a great time when you're packing up Christmas decorations, first of all, to clean out your storage so that you're getting to see if there's any mould or pests or any signs of anything like that's not right. And then after you pack them away, because you won't need them for another 12 months, start to tier your storage into things you'll use sooner.
Okay, right. This is storage tiering. This is a new one to me. Explain.
This is what I'm into. I think there is a lot of decluttering that is just getting loads of plastic boxes, throwing all your stuff into it, and then having gorgeously arranged plastic boxes.
Were you spying on me?
Listen, I'm telling you, there's this book, right, by this Irish author called Emma Gleeson, and it's called Stuff Happens. And it's not something that you need to read like right away and go straight into it. Take your time with it. It just talks about people's relationships with their stuff and how to organise your stuff without these plastic boxes. It's in an incredible book. And then what I always find is once you do know that everything that's in your home is kind of stuff you want to hang on to, you've got to think about how you use it. Most of us are short on storage and short on space, and also we don't want to be rummaging every day, you know. So what I would do is when you're putting away your Christmas stuff, it should be at the back of everything, because you know you need everything else sooner than these Christmas decorations. And then start to group stuff. That's like my best advice. So like when you realise you've got 16 pairs of scissors, you'll be more comfortable with letting some of them go when you're looking at all of the one thing. And then I tend to just put things that I use on a daily basis in the most accessible parts of my my wardrobe and storage, and then things that I use kind of one off or like I won't be using till the summer, then they'll go further back. And then seasonally you'll start to rotate that around, and then it'll be easier to say, God, I actually didn't even use that last year, I don't need it, I'll donate it.
That makes sense. But you see, if you have two or three tin openers, for example, the reason you keep them, Laura, is because one goes missing, you have a spare one or a spare two.
Where's it going to go? Where's it going to go missing?
I don't know.
That's the chat you need to have. That's why you need to read the book.
I don't know where they go, but they go. Yeah.
Well, you can have two then, not three.
Not three, okay. And that's it. I've never thought of it like that before. So it's like the stuff that you use most often, closest to you, which makes complete sense when you say it out loud, but I've just never considered it before.
Well, I think with consumption, they don't want us to think about our stuff in a practical way. They want us to think that we always need more. One could go missing. That we need to have all the stuff around us for security, when actually moving freely and easily and calmly through our home and not feeling stressed by the stuff we live with is much more important, in my opinion.
I suppose people think that if they throw something out, they're wasting it, and they'd love to think that they could find it a new home.
Listen, if you think that was important enough to live with you for that long, someone else is going to find use in it. So I wouldn't just throw everything into a black plastic bag and put it down to the local charity shop. Like, if you see, you can watch this on most social media platforms, there's going to be someone who runs a charity shop saying that there's stuff they don't need and you're giving them rubbish.
Yes.
So, like, I, for example, if I'm ever giving away a winter coat, I always Google the shelters in my area that need winter coats, and I make sure that they need them for my size, and they'll say like women's suits or whatever. And then sometimes when you look up what people in your area are looking for, you might realise, actually, hang on, I haven't worn these suits in ages, I'll donate them. Someone needs them more than I do. So we've got to kind of think about where we're donating as well. And even things like old bedding, a lot of animal shelters, if you ring them, they'll take them for bedding, for temporary beds for dogs and stuff. So like, there is a way to repurpose a lot of stuff.
You have to do a bit of work on it, because I think some people, and I would include myself in the past, of using charity shops really as a dump. You know, you're going, I've a load of books, I've no room for them anymore. Where can I drop them off? And you don't do too much thinking about it. Now, after Christmas, there was a lot of cooking going on. There was a lot of gravy. There was a lot of juices flowing here and everywhere. So the oven, I'd say, is looking the worst for wear.
Oh, I'd say now she's had the time of her life all Christmas. So she's looking for a nice treatment, a spa treatment. I think a lot of people will reach for like the really harsh oven cleaners. I went through a stage at work where I was cleaning an oven like once to twice a week in different apartments, and I just didn't want to use those harsh cleaners. They're kind of quite bad for you, and then you've got to burn them off afterwards, which kind of proves they're not that good. So I started using bicarb, vinegar, washing up liquid, warm water and microfiber cloths, and it's really easy. You just make basically a paste out of bicarb and you can scrub the grease off. Usually you leave it overnight if you can, the trays and stuff like that, but it's just really easy to do naturally. Like, there's loads of videos online on how to do that as well, but I would do that. And then you're not, I say nothing that you prepare, eat food off or store food in should be, you shouldn't use a cleaner that you wouldn't clean your plates with. So make sure you're using natural, like an emollient, like bicarb, things that are acidic, and degreasers like vinegar are much better.
Will you just remind people about the vinegar that you use for cleaning?
I will. My favourite. So distilled white vinegar made in a lab. I wouldn't kind of bother going down through things like balsamic or cider vinegar. They're more expensive, and B, there's a fermentation period that it goes through that doesn't make them as acidic. I use just regular vinegar that you'd put on food. It's about
But there's cleaning vinegar available
there's
now
cleaning
in most
vinegar,
supermarkets. Yeah.
Cleaning vinegar, the difference usually is it might go up to 6.5%. There's also vinegar that you can put in food that's like 8% that they use in a lot of Turkish food. But as some of our homewares can't hack that level of acidity, so I like to go nice and safe and easy down the middle to a 5.5. Things like, you know, Heinz, Saracens, I use stuff like that. I find that it is actually fine.
If I'm using my washing. It says that figure on the bottle, does it? The figure you're quoting.
Yeah, it'll say it on it. And like, to be honest, like, I do like a bit of vinegar on chips and stuff like that. So like, I'll have it in the cupboard for all the reasons.
Okay, cleaning and chips.
There we go.
Dolores was on to us just while we're on the oven. I'm looking for something to clean a gas cooker hob. It's burnt into it at the moment. I'm trying a concentrated industrial degreaser with a scrub. Please help.
Well, I saw the picture and it's enamel from what I can gather. This is so like a white stovetop, and the degreaser won't fully work on that because of the type of composition that it is. So what you can do instead is, if you get bicarb again into your paste and you if she takes off the top, the burner off the top there, and then puts the paste onto it, like a face mask, like she's having a stunning face mask, leave her on for about an hour, that will start to break down the stain. What you want to do is basically loosen that up enough that it's going to come off the enamel. You can then spritz it with a bit of vinegar mixed with water, but to be on the safe side, I would just use washing up liquid. Some enamel can't take vinegar if it's left on, if you don't wash it off properly. If you know you're going to wash it off properly, it's fine. And that will basically break down that burned on stain. The reason is that the stain went on and it got cooked again and again. Mm-hmm. So the heat baked the stain into the enamel, and bicarbonate works wonders for that. Just like it does with tea stains on cups, it just loosens it off.
Right. Now, last thing, we leave them with this, and it is because people are looking at the decorations. Tomorrow's the 6th of January. Traditionally, everything is taken down. So any tips on, you know, storage, the proper way to store your decorations and your lights, etc.?
Well, what I like to do is, if you have like tin foil that it's being used, or like parcel wrapping tubes, wrap your lights around them. It's much easier than that H-shaped card that a lot of people do, because you just wrap it around the pole and it's easier to store. Then what I like to do is get boxes. There'll be boxes from something, cereal boxes, whatever you have in your recycling, and stack them into like a tiered stack that you sellotape or like glue together. And then that just becomes one stack of cardboard boxes that you pull out at once at Christmas, because there's nearly always a box of decorations that doesn't get used or whatever. It'll make the most of your storage, because it means they're stacked one on top of each other and they don't fall down throughout the year. So like, I would just stack them up and push them to the back of your storage. Egg boxes are great as well for baubles.
And the other thing is, you just reminded me there, when you bring down the boxes from wherever you store them over the Christmas to put the decorations back in, if there are decorations that you didn't use, it's probably a sign that you're not going to use them next year or the year after. So probably, good luck.
Yeah. I would agree.
Yeah, slán Christmas decorations. Now, I'm not saying goodbye to you. I'm just saying goodbye to Christmas decorations. Last one, you have 30 seconds. Have you got a New Year's resolution? What's your thing?
My New Year's resolution is to try and create more positive habits for myself. I'm not going to do anything dramatic, but just
more
to kind of...
More positive habits.
Things like longer sleep, going for more colourful food, rested, being nice to myself and kind of taking it easy.
Okay.
With longevity of life in mind is what I'm going for this year.
Nice. Okay. Laura DeBarra, thank you. Slán now. Good luck. See you. Bye.
Bye.
That's it from us. Who's on? I'm just looking here. Cormac and Sarah are on Drive Time this evening. We're back tomorrow at 3 o'clock. Enjoy the rest of your Thursday evening.
It's the Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1.